Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. This is a bit extra, as this time we'll be looking in a bit more about the context in which we played RPGs back in the day. In recent episodes, we've been talking about magic. But where did our understanding of magic come from? There's a tendency for us to forget the centrality of television informing our view of the world back in the 70s and 80s, as we are saturated with the bombardment of media from multiple sources. However, back then we relied on three channels on television, comics, and an infrequent trip to the cinema to get our injection of the imaginative. And books, of course. This time, we're joined by returning guest Stephen Brotherston, the co-author of the Scarred for Life books. He was the special guest at Virtual Grog Meet in April 2025. We invited him on to explore the world of Scarred for Life in general, but to focus on the role that magic and witchcraft had in burning itself into our consciousness. Judge Blythe, our resident rules lawyer, joins me in the room of role-playing rambling on the sofa for a Grogglebox while we watch an episode of The Hammer House of Horror. This was an anthology series for television produced in the UK in 1980. I'm not exaggerating when I say that it was as formative in our role-playing as any supplement that we'd read. Stories within the series infused our imagination and became the basis for scenarios and the worlds we created around the table. We look closely at the first episode in the series, Witching Time, written by Anthony Redd, who was a writer that contributed to my favourite episodes of The Professionals and adapted Chocky by John Wyndham for television for a memorable series. At the end, we have a chat about some of the games we played and ran as part of Virtual Grog Meet. I'll be back at the end of the podcast with news of a new virtual event planned in November. Well, ramblers, let's get rambling. Hello, welcome to the Zoom of Role Playing Rambling, where I'm joined by a returning guest, the co-author and creator of Scarred for Life Universe, coming alive from somewhere near Penny Lane. Hello to Stephen Brotherston.
Hello, Dirk. It's lovely to be here. Oh, there we go, volume three.
Volume three. So since you're last on, this has been published, hasn't it? Volume three of Scarred for Life. Do you want to remind everybody what the Scarred for Life universe is all about and what you've been doing in this project?
Yes, sure. It's we always say this in our live shows, but it basically came from a conversation that I had with Dave Lawrence, my co-author, and one of my mates who used to work in Forbidden Planet in Liverpool, up in Bold Street, the home of the time slip as well. 23 years I was there and didn't even get a sniff of a time slip. It's terrible. It was a quiet morning. We were waiting for a delivery, no customers, and we just had one of those conversations that every generation has, but Generation X's always seem to revolve around, do you remember that comic with the shark that was biting people in half? And do you remember that film where, I don't know, Arthur Lowe's head gets chopped off and rolls off the bed? It just the awful, scary public information films that we grew up with, all the horror-themed games and toys and sweets, ice cream that we had as kids. And after about an hour and a half of this conversation, we had to get back to work. We had a delivery. I couldn't get this out of my head because everything that we talked about was scary or shocking, violent, sometimes racist in terms of the sitcoms. And most of it was aimed at children. And I just wanted to read the book that I just assumed someone somewhere out there had already written about all the dark side of the 70s and 80s. And there wasn't anything. It was all spangles and space hoppers and Bay City Rollers. So the next day in work, I was talking to my mate Col again about it. And he said, well, why don't you write the book? You like writing? and I just laughed in his face, but couldn't get it out of my head, made loads of notes, started planning this book, and the next time Dave was in, he was one of our oldest customers, said to him, look, Dave, you enjoy writing as well. Do you want to join me on this project? We won't finish it. It'll just be a bit of fun. It'll be a hobby, but there's no chance we're going to finish it. But here we are, like 11 years and 3 volumes later. But this is the thing. It became a social history of Britain in the 70s and 80s by accident. We didn't mean to tell that side of things as well. But when you do talk about sort of violent comics and racist sitcoms and toys and games that were often quite inappropriate for children, you can't help but talk about why these things were acceptable back then. Well, in Volume 3, this is the thing, because it's our teenage years in the 80s. So this is where I'm getting into role-playing games and big, complex board games. So I'm loving all that side of things.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying as well that this isn't just a listings book. It's not,
no.
It's not like something you would find on the internet, on Wikipedia.
No.
It goes beyond that, because what you provide, what you're explaining there, is a bit of a social history context, a commentary, analysis, as well as a deep description of what actually happened in some of these things, or what these things actually were. So that's why they're so thick, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And we had to cut stuff down. This is the thing. That was the first rule we made, me and Dave. It started in the era of those, remember those clip shows they used to have on Channel 5 and Channel 4?
Mm.
About the 70s and 80s, but it would always...
Stuart McConey was always on them, wasn't
he? Yeah. See, because he loves this stuff, but they'd always have like 22-year-old comedians taking the mickey out of it, making fun of wobbly sets and clothes. And that was the first rule we made. We love this stuff. We're not going to make fun of it. We're not going to mention the sets wobbling, just a brilliant script. So we're very reverential, and we do absolutely adore this stuff.
So the third volume is Pop Culture in the Shadow of the Bomb. And it's really the second... It's the second volume of the 80s, isn't it? And
yeah.
Even this has got two parts to it, because you do all the pop culture stuff at the beginning. The first volume of the 80s covered the television. But
yeah.
The last half of this is to do with the Cold War, isn't it? And how that influenced our imaginations and popular culture. Why do you think that was so important?
Because between 1983 and 84, well, this is the thing, the 70s book is when me and Dave are kids, little kids. So it deals with a lot of kind of the Osborne Book of Ghosts and stuff like that. And, you know, the children's shows and the dramas at the time were to deal with monsters and ghosts, and there's a lot of dystopia. But a lot of it was to do with things that we didn't know if they were real. It was monsters, ghosts, the paranormal. The 80s is rabies and AIDS and the heroin hysteria and the Cold War. Our teenage years when stuff got real. From 83 to 84, and I'm not exaggerating, every single day I wondered if that was going to be the day I was going to die, because it wasn't a question of if they were going to press the button. It was, when are you going to press the button? It felt like the world was going to end before 1990. We have to give a lot of space to address the comics, films, books, music, everything to do with the threat of nuclear war. It was such a huge thing back then. For a teenager, we were getting on with our lives. We were watching Ghostbusters and Gremlins and Only Fools and Horses, but that was looming over everything.
And I've got to mention, because this week has been the announcement of a possible remake of Threads.
Yeah.
By the same people who did Adolescence and Toxic City on Netflix. So how do you think that would go?
Do you know what? Normally, my knee-jerk reaction to remakes is, oh, God, really, these days? And I think a lot of people expected that from me on social media, on Twitter. People were asking me. I think it's a great idea, because if it's done properly, because it's a Sheffield-based production company. But the main reason is, as much as I love Threads, I think it's... I'll probably never watch it again, because I find it too difficult to watch, but I think it's the single greatest one-off drama this country's ever produced. The problem is, it's still stuck in 1984. I think we need a new nuclear, with everything that's happening, with the way the world's going, we need a new nuclear war drama that is going to shock people. The thing is, you may as well remake Threads. If they make a new nuclear war drama, it will inevitably be compared to Threads. So sod it. Let's just remake Threads. My only worry was the press release. where they were saying it's a story of hope and resiliency amongst awful. And I was like, no, it's threats. It's got to be bleak from frame one to frame eight. There has to be no hope. That's the whole point of it. But I think it's necessary. I think we need an update for the 21st century, I do.
So having Stephen Graham getting cross about something rather than Reece Dinsdale looking scared.
It's got to be. I mean, Stephen Graham's never going to turn up in a Home to Roost reboot. He always has a frown on his face. But yeah.
Oh, okay. And one of the reasons I've invited you back, Steve, obviously to celebrate the release of the book, but on the podcast recently, we've been looking at magic.
Yeah.
And in November last year, I went to see your show with Bob, and Bob's been on the program as well. And I had the realization during that show and reading your Scarred for Life books is that my imagination about magic hasn't come from primary sources. It's come through the filter of popular culture and my exposure as a kid to how magic is presented on TV, comics, and film. And that's a big topic, isn't it, in your folk horror shows?
It is, yeah. Do you know, that's a really interesting... Well, Bob's listening. This is something we might have to think about, but you're absolutely right. It's my exposure to magic was the same. It was Doctor Strange comics and John Constantine from DC, and obviously role-playing games, magic systems, D&D. It was waving your hand around, saying a few words, and these amazing, miraculous things happen. With D&D, you might have your ingredients and your preparation time. But yeah, it's this kind of thing that you open a big dusty tome and you study for a decade and then you can do whatever you want. But that's absolutely right. And folk horror as well, in the folk horror show. Wurzel Gummidge. We talk about Wurzel Gummidge in a folk horror show. I will absolutely die on the hill that the Crow Man is a magic user, because he, a druid maybe in D&D terms, he creates these creations, these scarecrows, and breathes life into them and lets them get on with their lives. But in the folk horror show, we do talk about, I guess you could call real magic, Wiccan, the religions that built up around witchcraft with Gerald Garner and Alex Sanders. That boom in the 70s, the suburban witchcraft and the people gathering in kind of basement flats and taking the clothes off and dancing around. But there was always built from a kernel of reality and reverence and really believing that magic is real, even down to kind of, I don't know if you're aware of a comic book writer called Grant Morrison, Scottish, amazing, one of my top three up there with Alan Moore. They're a practicing magician. They wrote a comic in the 90s, which is still one of my favourite comics ever, called The Invisibles, which starts in Croxteth in Liverpool with a Scally lad who's in a gang. It turns out that he is going to save the entire multiverse. And this cell of operatives, the Invisibles, protect him and bring him in because there's an incursion from another dimension of evil and decay. But there's a lot of what we would call, like with Alan Moore's beliefs in magic as well, a lot of magic in that comic. And Grant Morrison would cast spells while he was writing the comic. He put himself in the comic as the main character, King Mob, who's also a bald guy. And he is one of the plots in the comic, gave King Mob that, remember, necrotizing fasciitis, the flesh-eating virus that was a big media hysteria in the 2000s. He gave King Mob that as a plot. It was a three-parter, I think. He had to kind of overcome that. But he got it in real life a month later. Put him in hospital, he nearly died. But he was casting spells while he was writing The Invisibles. He swore blind. A scorpion god appeared in his bedroom after he cast a spell. He does admit that he takes copious amounts of psychedelics, which may have had something to do with it.
Yeah, that'll help.
Yeah. But you're absolutely right. The folk horror show and folk horror and that era of witchcraft in the 70s, when it became a tabloid menace, is a fascinating thing, and it is the prism through which we see magic.
Well, yeah, I think there was like you mentioned a suburban witchcraft. There was a sense of curiosity in the 60s and 70s. When my late father-in-law passed away, a part of his book collection was Dennis Wheatley
Oh, wow.
And books about witchcraft. And he was like a mild-mannered, he just had a fascination with it. And in your show, you mentioned that there was actually magazines on the newsstand, weren't they, for witchcraft?
Yeah, yeah. And there was a magazine called Witchcraft, which it's one of my life's missions is to buy a copy, but they're in kind of triple figures per issue on eBay. But it was essentially, I mean, you'd have it on the top shelf next to the smutty magazines. And it would always have like a naked woman on the front and there'd be a ritual and a man with a goat mask. But you would have these articles and multi-part stories, and it seems to be the playboy of the underground occult scene. As in, yes, they would have photo shoots with naked women. But if you ever see like early episode copies of Playboy, these are serious magazines with serious articles and interviews. So that was on your news shelves. You go and pick up your copy of your Sunday newspaper and a comic for the kid. And there on the shelf would be Witchcraft magazine. This is a thing as well that made me think we may put this into the next time we do the folk horror. I saw an article on Instagram. Someone was talking about, you know, the lurid witchcraft novels and books, the real books about witchcraft you get in the 70s. It was something that suburban housewives would buy and secrete away. And like you said about your late dad, he was a mild-mannered guy. These are just suburban housewives, but it was a kind of a resistance movement because they were quite empowering books for women. And even in America and Britain, you know, remember Bewitched, the sitcom with Elizabeth Montgomery? So you had that housewife who was also a witch. And I just remember it growing up on Channel 4 and loving it. But apparently there was a small section of housewives in America who found it very empowering. And that was kind of grew to that thing of buying these books and hiding it in a drawer away from your husband. Because these books were very much about casting spells and kind of freeing your shackles kind of thing. So that was quite fascinating to me as well.
Over recent days, I've been watching The Hammer House of Horror from the...
Fantastic.
And it is that realisation that nakedness plays a big part in when magic's covered, isn't it?
It does. It really does. And this is I think you had Gerald Gardner, who founded Gardnerian Wiccan, who was also a naturist. And it's unavoidable. The two just kind of intertwine for whatever reason. It's always sex parties, throwing off your clothes and sort of having a little ritual. But naturism and nudity plays a huge part in witchcraft. And there was a documentary I found on YouTube, one of the channels I follow. It basically posts bizarre documentaries about the paranormal and the occult from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And there was one from the early 70s that was, I think it was an Arena, BBC episode of Arena or Everyman, Man Alive, one of those. But it's got like full frontal male nudity all the way through because it's given access to a coven and they're performing their rituals and everyone is stark naked for whatever reason. I guess it's going back to nature and throwing off the shackles of modern life kind of thing. But you're absolutely right. It runs through like a stick of Blackpool kind of thing.
Yeah. And I was surprised in your show, the mention of my second favourite playaway presenter, because my first favourite was obviously Brian Cant.
Of course.
Tony Arthur's connection with it all, because I think I knew that she was a folk singer, but I didn't realise that how involved she was in that kind of witchcraft, etc.
This is actually my favourite story in the show, my favourite part of the show. It was kind of Bob's the authority on this kind of thing. But so we've got Alex Sanders, who's basically, him and his wife Maxine Sanders are kind of the posh and becks of the witchcraft scene in London in the 1970s. A shameless self-promoter. He's the founder of the Alexandrian Wiccan Society. He's the high priest. His wife Maxine is the high priestess. And they operate out of this basement flat in Notting Hill. And every time we talk about this, I always think, oh God, the poor neighbours, because they're having rituals and God knows what else going on, their sex parties going on. So you've got kind of this guy who's on chat shows and loves the limelight. And on the other side, you've got Dave and Tony Arthur, who are folk singers, who released this incredible folk album, Hearken to the Witch's Rune, which is Bob's favourite album of all time. It's an astonishing folk album. And they feel like, right, we need to experience a bit of the life as research if we're going to record this album. So they ring up, they find Alexander's in the phone book, kind of under witchcraft in the yellow pages, I don't know. But they ring him up and go, look, Alex, we're two folk singers and we're recording this album. We want to get involved. We want to feel what it's like. And Alexander says, yeah, you're absolutely welcome to come along, flat in Notting Hill. I have to warn you, it will be a sex party if you're okay with that. At which point they go away as a married couple and think, I don't think we want to get involved with this. And ring him back and go, do you know what? Thanks for the offer, but I think we're going to have to say no. So Alexander says, I'm glad you said that, because if you'd have said yes, I'd have turned you down, because that's not what we're about. So you're absolutely welcome to come. And they go to his flat and they get involved in witchcraft and Alexander's coven, and they do dance naked in his flat with the rest of the coven and go back and record this incredible album. And a year later, as you say, Tony Arthur is a presenter on Play School and Play Away, which is, as we always say in the show, can you imagine if that happened today? The absolute storm that would happen, but because it was the 70s, it was just like, and Bob interviewed them for an article in 14 Times about Hearken to the Witch's Rune. And he said to Tony, he said, well, did it never occur to you at the time, you know, you kind of a year previously to you appearing on Play School, you were dancing naked in a coven? And she looked and said, do you know what? It's never occurred to me before, darling. He said, we were just hippies. It was the 70s. It was just what we did. just brilliant. But that crossover into mainstream culture is amazing. I also talk in that section about Shadows, incredible ITV supernatural anthology show for children at 4:45 in the afternoon. And we've got an episode called The Witch's Bottle, which was written by a guy called Stuart Farrer. And it's this very positive portrayal of witches. We talk about Matthew Hopkins, and this episode portrays Matthew Hopkins as the evil man that he was. But Stuart Farrer was a practicing Wiccan high priest as well. So you've got actual high priests, kind of witches, who are talking to children about how it's a good thing. Witchcraft's ace. Kids, don't worry about it, kind of thing. It's an amazing time to be alive.
And it was also in other examples, wasn't it? I think you've mentioned Bill Bixby's magician.
Yeah, this is the thing. The crossover was amazing. I mean, magic in all its forms, it was a big thing in the 70s. He was a stage magician who fought crime. But there was always, as a kid, that hint that this is a guy who can perform real magic. And yeah, you've got Doctor Strange. You've got Ace of Wands, the 70s ITV show for kids, who was another stage magician, but he had genuine powers. He would fight weird supernatural threats. I mean, God, there was so much of it around. Again, Doctor Strange comics, that kind of crossover between real magic and the absolute mainstream. There was that real fascination. There was no variety show in Britain that went without a magician. That was another thing about Alex Sanders. He was a practicing high priest. Before the last folk horror show we did, I was asking Bob a bit more. He fascinates me. Him and Maxine ended up doing the working men's clubs, the wheel tappers and shunters working men's clubs. They would do the working men's clubs. It was almost a weird, dark magic show. So you would have the singer, and then you'd have your Bernard Manning style comedian, and then Alex and Maxine would come on and do a ritual in front of all these drunk men and women.
Amazing. Brilliant. That's what I call entertainment.
Absolutely.
And all of this stuff, as you mentioned, kind of infused into role-playing games.
Yeah.
And I think it probably formed in other people's imaginations what the games were about. So if you weren't participating, your view of it was that somehow it had connection with witchcraft, and that's where you get the emergence of the satanic panic and that kind of response to gaming. And you write extensively about that in the third volume.
Yeah.
So we didn't really encounter it in the same way as it did in the US, but it was still apparent, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the thing. It's we were very much aware of the satanic panic to do with D&D, but it was very much at arm's length. I mean, that's a strange story. It all starts with a non-fiction book called Michelle Remembers in 1980. It was co-written by a woman and a psychiatrist. She went into therapy and apparently unlocked repressed memories in an inverted commas and about 27 asterisks next to it, because it was debunked forensically countless times. So she maintained that she grew up with a mum who was in a cult, a satanic coven, and she was subjected to the most, it's an awful list of horrible depravity. But they basically made what would, in today's money, I think, be about $1.5 million out of this book. They were on the chat show circuit. They were famous for a little bit of time. But that planted the seed in America that witchcraft was back, Satan was back. This is a deeply religious country as well, by the way, as it was back then, as it is now. So the next sort of spark that lights the fire is James Dallas Egbert. Was that his name? I think I'm terrible with names. James Dallas Egbert, yeah. A deeply lonely, repressed guy with mental health problems and a D&D player who leaves a suicide note, goes off into the steam tunnels where he and his mates were LARPing, and goes missing. And the detective, the private investigator that's investigating, finds out he's a D&D player, puts two and two together and says, well, that must be the thing that's caused him to go mad, not the fact that he's deeply lonely. And I think he was repressed, homosexual, all kinds of things that led to this. So that case, when he finally did take his own life, sadly, that was the angle that the media focused on, D&D. So this erupts in the 80s in America into D&D is evil. D&D players are unwittingly partaking in witchcraft and Satanism, and these spells are real. There's a bizarre documentary that you can find on YouTube. I think it's called the Degeneration of a Generation or something like that, where they're talking about these incidents where mums and dads are throwing their kids like DM's guides and player handbooks into a fire, and you can hear it screaming and there's monsters forming in the smoke, because the hysteria, the genuine hysteria that erupted was insane. But this grew and grew. Throughout the 80s, you've got Patricia Pulling and the organization that she formed. It was
Bothered About D&D.
Yeah. And again, her son took his own life, but he was a D&D player, so her own grief caused her to lash out. I actually feel sorry for her, but she lashed out in the wrong direction. So you've got all this. You've got the Chick Tracts. You've got the famous Dark Dungeons, which is hilarious. The little comic book that the evangelical publisher Jack Chick drew and wrote. But it was always turning kids to the dark side. Now, you're probably the same as me, Dirk, and everyone out there watching this and listening to this is the same. As kids, we'd get into D&D. We'd go around our mates, get snacks, get Coke, and just have a laugh. And that's all it is. And have an argument. And row over not rolling your D20 properly. That's what D&D is. And you get into the stories. But it didn't really come to this country. Luckily, I've got a mate, one of my best friends, Chris, worked in the legendary Games of Liverpool. Just the best shop ever for me. Legendary role-playing and board game shop in the 80s, early 90s. And he can't find it now, but he has a letter somewhere from the British equivalent of BAD. It was, I think it was Mad Moms Against D&D, basically telling the shop, you must not stock Dungeons & Dragons, and they told them where to go. But the only story I've really got about this whole thing was one of Chris's mates in school was an RE teacher, and when he found out that his son was playing D&D, he kicked him downstairs. When I say kicked him, he booted him from the top stair to the bottom. Mm-hmm. I gave him a hiding. But I think the closest thing we had was that there's a little hysteria about fighting fantasy books, but I don't know anyone whose parents were particularly bothered who was touched in any way by the satanic panic, but we were aware of it, and we were kind of reading the reports, appalled, even as teenagers, and baffled by why people would think that this fairly innocuous game. I mean, TSR themselves, Gygax, everyone got reacted. I know they removed deities from deities and demigods, that kind of thing. It was, they had to kind of go on the back foot on the defensive.
I like the bit in the book where you talk about Jack Thomas Chick comic strips. I always find it amusing that the kids in it, their heads look like Buffy vampires, don't they? They're like in a permanent scowl, all of them. Yeah,
yeah, they're always frowning, always evil.
Which spell did you cast, Debbie? I used my mind bondage spell on my father. He was trying to stop me playing D&D.
Well, I'm in two minds. You know, obviously, as we know, D&D now is this multi-billion dollar industry. You've got celebrities playing it. And it's to the point now where I actually wonder whether D&D is a genre in itself, because I worked in Geek Retreat for a year and a half in Liverpool. And for the first time in my life, right, I grew up, the way it worked was, this was the timeline. You got into D&D as a kid, became obsessed with it. But then, within a year, you find out the Call of Cthulhu exists. You find out that Marvel Superheroes exists, Traveller, all these amazing games. So you're like, oh, and you never go back to D&D. It's the gateway drug. And for the first time, I was surrounded by customers who were obsessed with D&D. And I'm trying to get them into like free league games and Powered by the Apocalypse. And they call them indie games. I'm like, they're not indie. The Call of Cthulhu's huge. Like, these games are massive. It was a thing where I realized D&D is an industry in itself. Mm. And with the way that America's gone again, I'm calling it. By 2030, I think we're going to go through another satanic panic with D&D getting involved, because it's gone from a little game that's kind of this dirty little weird crude drawings to this multi-billion dollar industry that's got to be a target, surely, for evangelical Christians again. But we'll see what happens.
And you're still playing, aren't you? What's
absolutely
what you're playing at the moment? I know that you have an extravagant approach to your playing.
Well, this is, I guess so. We'll come back to that. I was listening to your latest episode, and it made me think. It's caused a big discussion amongst me and my mates. But this is the thing. I've been obsessed with role-playing games, board games, since 1979, when I was 9 years old. I bought an issue of White Dwarf, my very first issue of White Dwarf, from Games of Liverpool's other branch, smaller branch around the corner from my mum and dad's. And it had it was a tie-in to Star Trek The Motion Picture. I'm also a massive Trekkie. Had the Starship Enterprise on the front, so I had to buy it. And inside it had a little miniatures skirmish battle adventure for Citadel Miniatures range of Star Trek miniatures. I didn't understand any of it. I ended up drawing my own little counters and playing this game. But in the middle of this magazine, there was a D&D scenario called The Halls of Tizun Thane. I will never forget that name as long as I live. I remember staying up in bed that night, reading this adventure like a story, and make my way around the little map, this huge castle. Didn't understand, what were hit points? What is a movement allowance? I don't understand any of this. It blew my mind and it changed my life. But yeah, so it was kind of, I've basically been playing since 1979, but I will say I've been a GM for 80% of the time. I prefer to run games to play than playing them. I love running games, but I've gone through every game imaginable, obsessed with Marvel Superheroes. Cthulhu is a big one. But at the moment, I'm loving the kind of rules light, Free League, Year Zero, Alien, Blade Runner, that kind of thing, Forbidden Lands. There's a game called Outgunned, me and my mate Chris, backed on Kickstarter a couple of years ago. It's this action movie of 80s, 90s game that's just brilliant. It's incredible, but you can use it for any genre. At the moment, we've come back to a campaign I've been running on and off, very off, since 2009, called Miami Heat, which is basically 70s and 80s cops, but like the Avengers. What if Magnum and Kojak and all these classic cops were working for Miami-Dade's Vice Department? So you've got them all coming back one last time. It's a real cop show thing. But we kind of find ourselves going into weird genres. We played Mashed, which is a Powered by the Apocalypse game based on Mashed, the sitcom, and it's incredible. So I think this is the thing. You get into D&D and fantasy, and we find ourselves drifting into all the weirdest genres imaginable, but I am still obsessed. And I want to come back to your latest episode, Derek, because you and Blythe were talking about, I think you were talking about like the early 2000s, a period when you would go the extra mile when you're running these games, and you'd have music in the background, a soundtrack, you would curate a soundtrack. But the period said, I can't be bothered now, it's too much hassle. And I kind of was jolted. I was like, ah, because I can't imagine playing without music and props and handouts. And for Miami Heat, right, I curated an 80s music song soundtrack, a separate soundtrack that's just the music from Jan Hammer's music from Miami Vice, the music from Beverly Hills Cop in the background all the time. If something's going to happen that I've written into a story that I know is going to happen that's exciting or sad, I will play a specific song. I've cobbled together an actual minute-long title sequence on my computer using clips from various shows, and we play that at the start of every episode. And my mate Chris, he actually makes 80s bubblegum cards with each character and supporting character, so we know what everyone looks like. Not just music, man. We go the extra mile for every single game. So I can't imagine sitting there in silence playing a game, because it's the immersion for me as well.
Yeah. I only count, Steve, if you've got it on cassette, though.
This is the thing. Yeah, this is where we all fail. Absolutely. I completely agree. You've got to take a little advert break to put it onto side two.
This is the final volume of it. But
it is, yeah.
And the back of here, you promise some additional projects. So what is it that you're currently working on, Steve?
Just got the wheels moving on our next project. Basically, me and Dave have got book ideas to last us another 10 years easily, because we didn't realize how much this was going to explode, how much it was going to take off. It took us by surprise. These are all passion projects. So we realized we can actually do these things. But the next project, which we're hoping for the end of this year, might be next spring, is two more volumes. It's the Scarred for Life Book of Horror Stories. And it's going to be two volumes of short horror stories inspired by the Pan Book of Horror stories from the 70s and 80s. The incredible kind of lurid, gory short stories that you'd get and you kind of hide, you'd read under your bedclothes and swap with your mates. So the idea is that we've got outside writers. Well, we're going to do a call out. We're going to invite writers in, and it's going to be short stories based on the things we write about in the Scarred for Life books, public information, films, the scary kid shows, the comics. People can go wild. Nuclear war, 70s and 80s pop culture inspiring these horror stories. Like Dave Lawrence, my co-author, has already written a story each for the 70s and 80s volume. One about a kind of possessed Basil Brush style show that's killing the guests on his light entertainment show on BBC One. And another one that's, I don't want to give the twist away, but it's about the broom cupboard. Remember the Philip Schofield, Andy Crane and the broom cupboard?
Oh, yeah.
Head the duck. Yeah, it's a really dark turn on that. It's brilliant. But yeah, we're really looking forward to that. After that, the plan is to do a retro Scarred for Life annual, the kind of thing that you would find under your Christmas tree on Christmas Day, with puzzles and games and comic strips and stories. After that, we've got ideas for the Scarred for Life book of the paranormal, but we're going to look at how the paranormal has been portrayed in pop culture since the 70s and 80s. Book on music, hopefully do a book on games, role-playing games, board games and video games, because we talk about that. I wrote big sections on that, but all of these sections in volume 3, as big as they are, I always came away thinking I could do a book on this. We could easily do a book on this. But and yeah, loads of plans.
You're still on the road as well, aren't you? So I urge anyone who hasn't seen the show to, if it comes into your locality, to look it up and attend. So you've got some of those going.
The main show, which we do every now and again now, because Dave's basically a full-time carer. He's got a four-year-old kid, doesn't have as much time. Me and Bob haven't got a life, so we can do it whenever. But we've got the main show we've got coming up. But the folk horror show is the one that we've got pretty much one show a month this year. Doing a new show at the end of all our shows. We have a little Q&A for 25 minutes with the audience. We basically tell people who've got trains to catch and babysitters, if you need to leave, leave, by all means. But usually half the audience stick around and we just have a big group discussion. People share their memories. We talk in depth about what we've talked about in the show, what it means to them, and people share their scars. And we love it. For me and Bob and Dave, it's the favourite part of the show.
Thank you very much, Steve, for spending your Sunday morning with us.
It's oh, my pleasure. I'd love to come back again. I can talk about games all day long. This is the thing. Love to.
Grogglebox, welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling. I've got Blythe with me. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
Now, this is... sometimes I get a bit confused with this segment, Blythe, because we also have Starburst Memories and Groggleboxes, where we look at a piece of television, film, and try and relate to it, of the impact that it had on us back in the day and what we think about it now. But yeah, it's a Grogglebox. It's a Grogglebox.
Yeah. You get confused about the format. It is your format, so
yeah,
you don't have to worry. I don't think anyone can really complain.
Starburst Memories is very similar, but I think we cover more ground with Starburst Memories. So I don't know. I get confused myself. It's an editorial nightmare putting this podcast together.
There'll be letters of complaint, emails of complaint. Who writes letters of complaint anymore? Wonder anyone else.
And it's a public holiday, and you've had the house to yourself all day.
I've had the house to myself all day. Yeah, yeah. It's a rare old treat, isn't it? I've had that weird thing where you get up in the morning and you think, I've got the house to myself all day till about 8:30 tonight, and you think, oh. What should I do? What should I do? I could watch this. I could do that. Oh, my God. You go into a kind of weird paralysis of thinking.
Pick up the guitar. I could spend...
Yeah, so much
I could do. I could write scenarios. I could...
Yeah, that's what I've been doing. I've timetabled me there in terms of, right, do this now, do that now. It's harder than work, enjoying yourself.
got to make the most of it.
Got to make the most of it, yeah, because tomorrow it'll all end and my father-in-law's ready for his tea, oh no.
The delirium of choice, it's terrible, isn't it? It's terrifying. Yeah. We're going to talk about The Hammer House of Horror, which was an anthology series that was first broadcast on, well, Granada as it was, ITV, I guess, is what it's known as now, Channel 3, as we knew it back then, would you say?
Yeah, ITV. Well, let's just call it ITV or Granada, yeah.
Granada.
That was what it was in the north. They were all broken up into different companies, weren't they? So the northwest, you got Granada. Why is it called Granada? Why is it named after it?
I don't know.
Spain. Who knows? But anyway,
there you go. Trivia question.
Yeah.
So in my house back in the day, I think I've mentioned this before, but I know that in some houses, I know that Mrs. The Dice, this is the case, that they tended to focus on the BBC. They felt like that was more enriching and better.
Mm-hmm.
But in my house, it's a kind of an inverted snobbery that they would never watch the BBC. They would watch IT.
Really? We were a broad church, I think, with that. I don't think it mattered.
You were less sectarian when it came to your...
Yeah, I wasn't sectarian. We weren't sectarian with TV channels. That's the thing that's... I've become aware of as a grown up, really, as a kid. I'd go the only snobbery I remember was at school. There were some kids who watched Swap Shop on a Saturday morning, and then there were some kids who watched Tiz Wos.
Yeah,
and I watched Tiz Wos, and you were made to feel like it was a bit beneath them to watch Tiz Wos because it was just people throwing custard pies at each other, whereas Swap Shop was, you know. Somehow it wasn't. I'm Swap Shop. What was it? The intelligentsia, Noel Edmonds, Mr. Stripy Jumper, where people wanted to swap an action man for a skateboard. It's hardly a university challenge, is it? But apparently that's the way it was viewed for some strange reason.
Yes, it was slightly in love with itself, Swap Shop, wasn't it? It had like a very comfortable air of cosiness, whereas Tiz was had a sense of anarchy. And I think I mentioned before that we were in the position where we had were early adopters of the VCR, so I watched both. I used to have a thing for Maggie Philbin. But that let's go.
Did you? On to, Maggie Philbin? Sure, yeah. Sally J. Are you getting it confused with Sally Jane?
No, Maggie Philbin.
Okay.
Yeah, so ITV, first broadcast. I've got the figures here. Hang on. I made notes here.
Saturday night when it was on?
It was. I think it was Saturday night.
I have a vivid... I don't know if this is a false memory or not, but my grandma used to come and babysit. I was probably about 12. And my mum, let alone fact, my mum was a club singer, wasn't she? She would do the club circuit, my mum, when she was younger. And so my dad and my granddad would go off and she'd have a singing engagement in some northern working men's club. And my grandma would come and visit and babysit. And I was about 12, but not, my sister's a bit younger than me. So I wasn't old enough to be left on my own. But my grandma had a very liberal view of TV. So I remember watching it. My grandma didn't care. You know, like,
yeah.
There are things in the episode we watched which probably not appropriate for a 12-year-old. But I remember watching them because my grandma didn't care. She just sat there eating sweets and smoking fags. Well, watch where you want, kids. I didn't care.
But it was on at 9:15 and it first broadcast on the 13th of September. And you think you're right, it was on a Saturday, 1980. So we knew each other then. And I think this is one of the things that brought us together as friends. Yeah. We kind of shared our experience of watching it because it was like must-see television.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Because it was kind of, I mean, I suppose at that age, you hadn't really seen many horror films. I mean, you couldn't, could you? Because they were then called X certificates in the cinema, and you didn't have a video at that point. So, yeah, they were like a real kind of, they were a gateway into horror stuff, weren't they, really? That was
available. They were, yeah. And even though we had a video recorder, we weren't allowed to watch contemporary horror films, but I was permitted to watch like the black and white Universal Monster things. And I think that's what makes these so different. This appeared so different because they weren't like gothic horror monster films of Universal. These were like set in the real world. And I probably saw The Tales of the Unexpected, which is another anthology series, saw some of those. But these were a bit grittier, weren't they, than those?
Yeah, well, they were like horror. They were a mixture of, some of them were supernatural horror, weren't they? So there was one called The House That Bled to Death, I think, which was like supernatural. And a famous one called Charlie Boy, which I think we kind of talked about a lot, didn't we, about voodoo?
We did, because I used to have a Charlie Boy's about this wooden figure with lots of teeth that apparently put a curse on the people in this photograph who've been killed one by one.
I used
to have a money box that was made out of a coconut that we used to call Charlie Boy.
We used to call it Charlie Boy. Yeah. That's part of our secret language. If we mentioned Charlie Boy to each other, we'd know exactly what we were talking about. But there are others, I suppose, other Hammer House, some of the others in the series weren't supernatural horror. They were more just creepy kind of sinister stories about odd people. The famous one that a lot of people remember is, I think, the last one in the series with Peter Cushing in, where he owns a pet shop, doesn't he?
Yeah, I don't think that's the last one. I don't think that's the last one, but that is one of them. Yeah, but you're right. The Peter Cushing one.
Yeah, well, there's like is he like an ex-Nazi or something? And he traps people in this weird room. But it's not supernatural. There were a mixture, weren't there, of weird stories about evil people and then other stories about supernatural things.
And I think even the ones that had a supernatural basis left the door open to the idea that there might be some form of delusion, or without giving anything away, because some of them have a bit of a tricksy ending, don't they?
Yeah,
the last one, famously, is The Mark of Satan.
Right.
Yeah. That's another one that's pretty creepy. But the other ones that I remember particularly, The Guardians of the Abyss, which had Diana Dawes in it as a kind of matriarch for this group of werewolves. Do you remember that one?
I don't quite remember. I think the reason I don't remember them all is because of my grandma babysitting. If my mum hadn't got a singing engagement that weekend, well, I wouldn't have watched it. Whereas if my grandma was babysitting, I would. So when I look at the full list of them, there's ones I've watched, and that was my carefree chain-smoking grandma letting me watch them and not caring. And others that I didn't watch, I probably my mum and dad were home. I couldn't watch it because I was only 12.
I think when I see Diana Dawes, though, she's one of those people who transports me to that particular time and place because she was kind of a stalwart of British television. She appeared on panel shows and talk shows, and her former life was like a 40s, 50s bombshell. In later life, she became a bit of a household figure, didn't she? And she appeared in things as like a... I don't know, hard-nosed matriarch of a gangster-type roles.
Yeah, and it was that odd thing that as a kid, I think that's how we knew her. We didn't really know about her previous existence as kind of a glamorous woman. She was she kind of reinvented herself, like you say, as a sort of matriarch or kind of rather...
steely woman.
Steely, like tough woman. That's it. Like she was an East End gangster, sort of something like that kind of character. In her youth, she was a different kind of character, really.
The fairy godmother in Prince Charming video for Adamant. But she was everywhere, Diana Dawes. We're going to look at one particular episode, the first one, Witching Time, in a bit of detail. But I think the other thing to say about the Hammer House of Horror is, and I think I mentioned this when I talked about it, is Children of Stones, is that it is that creepy feeling that it's set in Britain and it gives a particular flavour of Britain at that time. It feels very contemporary. However, it didn't really relate to my life, the people and places within it. They all seemed a bit more aspirational, with the exception of perhaps the house that bled to death. The lifestyles of the people in there seemed kind of exotic, even though they were from the real world.
I think that's true. I think that's very true of the one we're going to look at, because they're all awfully posh. They're awfully posh, aren't they? All talk like that. You know, and they live in a farmhouse, never was. You think, you know, right, okay, with these people.
But they were recognisable of how contemporary life was portrayed on the TV in the 70s and early 80s, wasn't it? The middle class was presented as that's how everybody lived.
I suppose it did, but I suppose as well, what's interesting about that is the stories that they're telling are stories that somehow middle class people can be involved in. So in this particular one, it's set in a farmhouse, sort of in the middle of nowhere. And you'd think, well, it wouldn't work if it was set in Terrace Street, would it?
Yes.
It wouldn't work. It's almost like the middle classness of these people. As you say, when you watched them as a kid, they weren't like you and your family. But that kind of middle class thing is a conceit almost, or a narrative device to give a situation where what's going to happen can happen.
Yes,
the House of Bled to Death is a bit of an exception, because that's about people moving into a sort of semi-detached house, isn't it? It's a bit slightly different. But a lot of it is, you know, people with perhaps money who live in a big house, who live away from people, or who travel, or do this, or do that. They're kind of, you can involve them in these stories a bit easier, in a bit more easier way.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, that's the thing, isn't it?
It always seemed very exotic, the life on TV for these people. My dad always used to complain that people would come home from work in their suits and they'd have a crystal decanter of whiskey or brandy and pour themselves a large one after work.
Terry and June, he did that, didn't he? Terry and June, he'd sit, come home and he'd pour himself scotch and think, well, Dad doesn't do that. Who does that?
Yeah. And it's what I aspired to, you know. I mean, this is you know, it's Generation X. This is what polluted our mind. Never mind, scarred for life. It was like, this is what I want to do. I want to come home and
pour myself a massive scotch when I get home.
Anyway, so this is Witching Time. And the setup is that David Winter is a sound engineer and he's working on a film. So you get a bit of a false ending, don't you, where you're presented with a horror, a scene from a horror film. And yeah. It starts with a scream. And you learn
that's quite clever, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It starts with a bit of the film and you think, oh, some woman's been murdered, but it's not that film. Yeah,
it's a bit of a bait and switch, isn't it? Because he is alone in his home trying to get the soundtrack right for this. And I think that's a great NPC setup, isn't it? The person doing the sound.
Yeah, and again, the setup of he's in his house on his own and it's quite isolated, this farmhouse, so there's no one around. The last thing you want in it, if it was a scenario, you don't want a lot of NPCs. Not a lot of NPCs, one player character.
Isolated a lot. Yeah. And I think it's important from what we're saying is that he's drinking as well, isn't it? He makes a big play of the fact that he is drinking.
He's drinking and he's stressed about the film and he's overworking himself, isn't he? That's the general gist that's given of this character's under a lot of pressure and he's got some kind of, would it be fair to say, kind of mental health problems that born out of stress with his job?
Yes.
You know, that's the impression we're given of this guy.
Meanwhile, he gets a phone call from his wife, Mary, who is in bed drinking champagne with Ian McCulloch. Not out of Echo and the Bunnymen.
Not the one out of Echo and the Bunnymen, no. That would be quite something. It would be quite young, though, wouldn't he, then, I imagine? So that would be weird.
But it's Ian McCulloch who's in Survivors, isn't he?
Yeah, and he plays the he's the doctor in it.
The doctor, yeah. He turns up later as the doctor to come treat David.
He turns up as the doctor, doesn't he? And to treat him. So there's that kind of interplay there of his wife's knocking around with another fella who happens to be the doctor, who then says, you know, oh, you're under too much stress. That's the domestic setup, isn't it? Really.
Yeah. And she gives the impression that she's working on another film and she's working late and she is actually naked in bed. There's quite a lot of nudity in this.
There's a lot of nudity in it. I mean, there's a lot of nudity in it. And I still imagine my grandma on the settee chain smoking, not really caring. The 12-year-old grandson was seeing all this nudity.
There's a later one with Denham Elliott in the series, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's
totally unnecessary nudity as well. That's the thing, isn't it? It's completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
There's one scene where later on, where his wife is being kind of, there's some kind of trauma going on and all this kind of thing. And she spends like a whole scene in skimpy underwear. Completely unnecessary.
I suppose in that way, it is part of a tradition of British horror. Recently, I've been watching quite a bit of Hitchcock stuff, and his early stuff in the 1920s, The Lodger, features a woman getting into a bath covering. So that titillation, it's got to be recognised part of British cinema, isn't it? British television, particularly that era.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of it, wasn't there? That, when I think of the 70s, it's like Seaside Postcards and that kind of rather like casual titillation.
It's almost like if there's an opportunity, and it's very true in this one, if there's an opportunity for a bit of nudity, they will take that opportunity. Not legitimate that someone appears nude, but it fits in, then they will do.
One of her requests is to go and have a look at Muffin, and that isn't more titillation, that's the name of her horse.
That's the name of the horse, isn't it? Yeah. They got a horse. They got middle class. They got a horse.
They got a horse. And it is in his errand, his task of looking at Muffin, he discovers this woman, Lucinda, who's in there with a striking red permed hair up on her head. And she's looking a bit wild in a robe.
You get what happens is, as it unfolds, she claims to be a witch, doesn't she? So she is like from the past. So she doesn't understand the election.
Who is on the throne?
That's right.
There's Elizabeth.
Yeah. Elizabeth.
Which Elizabeth? Well, how would she know that was another one?
Why would she say that? I thought that. It's a stupid question. Because if she's from a time of Elizabeth I, which I'm not sure she would be, I don't think she is she? So And she says, "Which Elizabeth? What do you mean? Why would you say that? It's an odd question, isn't it?" The other thing as well, when she's in the barn, you do realise it's just a plot of Catweasel for adults, isn't it?
Yes.
So yeah. Kane Catweasel, that's the thing about a wizard who comes back in time, isn't it? He'd be persecuted, he comes back in time. When I was watching it, I thought, I didn't think this at the time when I was a kid, but now as an adult, I thought, hey, it's just Catweasel this, isn't it? But with nudity and horror. It's the same thing.
I think she does a good job of, in that scene, of portraying her. She's clearly a bit, people are pursuing her, and she's cast some kind of spell, hasn't she, to
escape? Yeah.
Escape.
She says it's worked, doesn't she? It's worked. So she's been, I think she, well, yeah, she's been persecuted. She's about to be executed as a witch. She casts some kind of spell and gets thrown forward in time. So that's where she is now, yeah.
And isn't that a great germ of an idea for a scenario? Yeah, an NPC.
It is a good idea. It's a good idea and it works. It's done quite well. I mean, it's quite a good setup, isn't it? You know, good setup once you realise, oh, right, so she's a witch from the past and she can use magic because she's used magic to get there. So
he has got a sense that feels a bit emaciated, doesn't he, in his relationship with his wife.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it, isn't it? That he knows she's up to no good, his wife. There's that sense. So he doesn't know it's with the doctor, but he knows that she's possibly up to no good and these excuses on the phone. So, and of course, the seductive witch plays into that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's where you get an idea that this, playing around with the idea that this might be him projecting this fantasy figure.
Yeah,
he brings into his home, doesn't he? And she gets startled by the electricity.
Yeah, and she's frightened of the shower.
Yeah,
which is a twist later on, isn't it? It's a twist later on. I think what's quite clever is they set up the idea, and they don't say this, but you do, or I did fall for it. You imagine she's going to be burned at the stake, so she's going to be burned as a witch.
Yeah,
that's what she's escaped from. Because at the very end, it's not water, it's not fire that she's frightened of. It's water, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, come on to that, but
yeah, a fear
that's
of
quite
the
a good twist, I think.
Yeah, a fear of the shower foreshadows her vulnerability, doesn't it?
Yeah. Weakness. That's her weakness. If you're playing liminal, that's her weakness, isn't it? If it was a liminal game, that's what under weakness it'd be water.
Steadily through the course of this interaction, he gets closer to her, but also starts to feel unsteady about it, unhappy about it. And that's where he calls for the doctor, isn't he? That's where the doctor, Ian McCulloch.
Yeah.
Not that one.
Not that one, the other one. Who's having it away with his wife, who gives him some kind of injection. And
he's really playing the same caddish kind of belligerent character that he plays in Survivors. And I was thinking that, you know, this could be in the same universe of Survivors. It could be the same character.
Yeah, it could be. Before the apocalypse, this is what he was up to. It's quite good, though, isn't it, in that, as you say, in some ways it's a straightforward story of man who discovers time-traveling witch. I said it's a straightforward story. That's not straightforward, is it? But you know what I mean. Man who discovers time-traveling witch who creates havoc because the witch is evil. But on top of that, it's got other layers, hasn't it? Because his wife is a bit of a wrong'un, isn't she, that she's doing that to him. And the doctor's a bit of a wrong'un because the doctor's kind of, there's a suggestion that he's like meddling with his medication and he gives him an injection. So the doctor's kind of playing around with him a bit and manipulating him in some way.
Yeah, that's what struck me about it. The fact that he is accepting this description. He's saying, I've seen this witch and this is what's happened. Let me show you where it is. Mm. And he's clearly, he's deluded. He knows that he's prescribing tablets to him and he's been drinking, but he decides to give him a shot of something well.
Yeah, yes, I know. I don't know. The doctors carried things like that in the bag in the 80s. I don't know. But yeah.
Later on, he gets worried about getting involved in it, that he might get struck off. I think his prescription.
Yeah, I think that ship has sailed. You should be struck off, actually. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's what's quite clever about it. And I suppose it kind of makes you think initially, the witch isn't, she's not that, maybe she's not that bad. Yeah,
precisely.
Dump your wife and run off with the witch. She's all right.
Precisely, because what the doctor does then, and he's concerned, he said, I'm giving him a shot, phones, you know, his lover and David's wife. You know, he says, oh, you know, he's not very well. He's in these delusions. I've given him some tablets and he's been drinking. And she says, oh, typical.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Typical.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he said, well, it's all right. I've given him a shot. And she said, I'll go around first thing, reluctantly. I'm going to go around first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
Her head hits the pillow. She's straight to sleep. She couldn't care less.
Couldn't care less, could she? Couldn't care less. The witch is okay, really. Well, she's not. As it transpires, she's not. No one comes out of it particularly well, I don't think.
Yeah. They're all flawed. They're all flawed.
But it is an interesting like dynamic that it sets up, I suppose, that, you know, these other two people in his life are not being very nice to him.
At this point, she goes to see David in the morning to see whether he's okay. And he's clearly in some distress.
That night when she's asleep, not caring less, he gets seduced by the witch, doesn't he? There's a bit of there's a sex scene, of course. And then she scratches his back, doesn't she?
Quite a gruesome scratch, actually.
It's quite a gruesome scene, isn't it? She scratches his back. And of course, when his wife comes home, she finds these scratches on his back. She rings the doctor and kind of says, oh, what's he done to himself? How's he done that? Which made me think, can you even do that to yourself? Like licking your elbow, isn't it?
I don't know. If you get a scratch and you can't reach it, you'd be surprised.
That's what you might do. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough, I suppose. But yeah, she kind of thinks what's going on there. And yeah, there's like a big there's, of course, there's the obligatory big argument then where he says, oh, she did it, this witch. And she says, there's no one here. And what are you talking about? You know, and all that kind of thing. And then I think it's the scene where she goes up to a bedroom and takes her clothes off and she's in the skimpy underwear. And then all sorts of weird stuff starts happening, which is the witch having a go at her because the witch has decided she wants David and she has to eliminate the wife. That's when the kind of action sort of really starts with all the supernatural stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, that's where you as an audience then start to think, oh no, this is really going on. And there's a headless crow flapping on the bed.
There is a headless crow. There's a headless crow flapping on the bed, which he buries. He buries. In a huge hole.
A huge hole? It's unnecessarily big.
Would you not put in a plastic bag in the bin? Is that just me? And where's his head? He doesn't find his head. But he buries it. He does. He buries like a mass. It's like a
hole. Massive hole. You could fix the put of television in it, couldn't you?
Couldn't you? Yeah, like an Alsatian or something in it. You know, like you put Alsatians down and bury me Alsatian. It's a headless crow. What are you doing? Why are you even burying it? Why would you even bury? Found a dead bird in the garden. Would you bury it? Would you give it a decent burial? Or maybe it's just me, but I wouldn't. Just open it up.
Yeah, and then the bath runs with blood.
Yeah, yeah.
And starts to go downstairs in the, as you mentioned, in her underwear.
Underwear.
And they've got a novelty Roman bust that every home should have.
Every home should have one. Yeah.
Precariously at the top of the stairs. I mean,
it's not a good place for it to start with, is it?
If you're doing a risk assessment on this, you would not put a novelty Roman bust at the top of a spiral staircase.
Yeah. I think it was worth saying novelty Roman, unsecured novelty Roman bust. I mean, if it had been secured in somewhere, fair enough, but it is fair to say it is unsecured. In the witch's defense, there's lots of other stuff, like the blood in the bath, and there's all this kind of storm of wind in the bedroom with all things blowing. All that, I think, is the witch's fault. The novelty Roman bust could be a genuine accident, though.
Yeah.
Couldn't it? Because it's unsecured. Could have happened any time, that.
Accident waiting to happen, that one.
I don't think the witch is necessarily to blame for that.
It's at this stage, isn't it, where, again, the accusations fly. She has to confront the idea that actually this might be happening.
Yeah, there's a few bits and pieces that then happen where she can't really blame him because he's downstairs when it happens or something happens where she's, you know.
So she does her library use role.
She does, doesn't she? She goes to see a vicar, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Who's granddad? It's granddad from Only Fools and Horses, isn't it? The actor.
It is.
Granddad. He's not acting like Grandad in Only Fools and Horses. He's acting
again,
like
again though, it would be great, wouldn't it, if it was in the same universe as Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah. He got to the church and there's a yellow three-wheeler parked outside.
Yeah. But yeah, it's Grandad from Only Fools and Horses. And they find, don't they, reference to Lucinda, Mistress Lucinda Jessop.
Yeah.
In the past.
Yeah. It's like a little scene with the vicar for members of the audience who don't really know anything about witches and witch finders, isn't it? It's really just a exposition bit where they go, oh, yeah, she's a witch. And, oh, yeah, they were hunting them. And, oh, yeah, she disappeared and no one ever found her. And, right, okay. It's just a exposition thing, really, isn't it? But it does the job of convincing her as well that there's something amiss and something wrong with all this. So
we cut to Lucinda again, a bit of nudity, and it is she getting in deep with David, isn't she? It's kind of she's kind of got him under her spell, under her control. But clearly, Mary needs to deal with this, and when she gets back, she discovers that a fetish has been created of her, doesn't she? Like a little voodoo doll.
Voodoo doll, yeah. She's getting pains in her side and stuff, isn't she? And there's this voodoo doll, yeah. And then he goes, then it kind of escalates quite rapidly, and he goes a bit bonkers and builds a bonfire outside, doesn't he, with a stake tied to it. Again, kind of suggesting a witch being burnt at the stake, and he sets fire to it and stuff, and
It doesn't make this clear, but I think it's the witch controlling him preparing the stake for his wife, for Mary.
Yes. Right. That's he's clearly under a spell then, isn't he? And she's driven him kind of mad, and he's doing that because he says to her, "Will that do?" Doesn't he, to the witch?
Yeah.
That idea that his wife is having an affair, and she's, it's like a witch, that kind of thing. Plays around with those ideas. I think when I was 12, I would never have picked up on. But when I watched it now, I thought, hey, it's quite clever. There's ideas in it banging around that are sort of interesting. His wife isn't completely guilt-free, is she? You know, it's almost like a kind of morality tale of sorts, isn't it? You know, his wife has been unfaithful and has been bad to him. And now this is what's going to happen to you. You're going to be burnt as a witch, you know, the idea that, you know.
Of course, she seeks help from her lover, Ian McCulloch, not that one. And that's at the point where I can't really get involved in all this.
I can't really get involved in witches and people being burnt at the stake. The British Medical Council will never
accept it. Never mind that I'm having it away with my patients and drugging
her husband, overstepping the mark on the medication with her husband. Never mind that. But I'm afraid dealing with a supernatural entity from another century is a step too far. And I'm used to it. Sorry, darling. Can't get involved. Puts a phone. You never see him again. That's it. He's not involved anymore.
So the final confrontation, she starts to mess with the fetish that she's created. Ooh. And there's a battle. And she realises the water is her vulnerability.
That's right. Yeah, that's the big reveal, isn't it? That it's actually, she's not frightened of the fire. She was going to be kind of possibly drowned or something like that, wasn't she?
Yeah.
So it's the water that she fears,
She ends up in Muffin's
feeding trough. Yeah, she drowns in the water.
Drinking trough,
doesn't she? But then she disappears, and then she heard her laughing, don't you, at the very end. And he gets hold of the little voodoo doll and throws it on fire, doesn't he? And she screams. So, not quite. It's one of those things in a lot of horror films where you think, I'm quite sure what's going on there. What's going on?
Yeah.
She disappeared. Is she in the voodoo doll now? I don't know, whatever. But that's what happens at the end. And they presumably live happily ever after. And change the GP, let's hope.
Do you do my health? I mean, going back to them, and I really want to watch more. I realise that it's part of my imagination. These are like the foundational elements of my imagination. And even now, when I'm facing doing a Call of Cthulhu adventure or a liminal adventure, these are the stories that I draw upon.
You realise how kind of formative those kind of things were, really, in the way you approach things.
And you can see with Inside Number 9 how they've used it as a homage, a pastiche to create the series that they created, the anthology series that they created. Mm. And they tap into particularly this one. I mean, I think there's one that almost makes direct references to this.
There style. Is one. There is one that's like a witch trial.
But I think there's a lot you can draw upon. However, I always think that there's a limitation when it's in the contemporary world, isn't it? When you bring magic in this very small way to a game, it doesn't have the same effects. It doesn't have the same effects because as protagonists, the PCs behave differently to these incidents than people in fiction do.
Yeah, that's true, because I suppose the setup of that story is quite a good one for a role-playing game, right? You're in this old house in the middle of nowhere and this witch appears from the past and she's got it in for you. That's quite a good little one-shot scenario, isn't it? But you're right. Once you get beyond that, of course, because it's a drama, it plays out differently. Because the way he reacts is very different from the way maybe a player character would react. Player characters probably would try and fix the problem pretty quickly rather than mess about denying its existence and thinking it's not real. And I think as well, as you say about magic, going back to what I said earlier about the fact that they're quite wealthy and live in a house in the middle of nowhere, et cetera, is a mechanism for allowing magic to happen without it kind of disrupting the wider world. Because that is one of the problems with magic in a contemporary setting. You have to somehow limit its use, don't you? Or have some kind of controls on it, because suddenly if you don't do that, it's not the real world. So it's a bit like when you play things like Liminal. There's this hidden world, but it's a hidden world that is hidden, and hidden to some extent by agreement. So the supernatural entities, it either suits them to hide their existence, or there's agreements between the mortal world and the fae that these things will be hidden, because that's the way you get magic to operate in a contemporary setting. You can't have it open and sort of everywhere, otherwise it stops being the contemporary world. It stops being the real world, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I suppose the other way to use this element is, the thing I was thinking was that, what if you were investigators who came onto the scene at the point where this has been reported and the things being missing, and you're just left with this and have to piece together the story. Yeah. And you've got some evidence there around the taped recordings that he has of the laughter.
Yeah. Piece together what's happened.
And, you know, you still got the doctor who you can consult.
Of course, yeah. Maybe he's still around. Yeah, he's the reluctant kind of witness who won't want to speak. The other thing I thought as well when I was watching it in terms of role-playing is, I've thought this before and I've never really done much about it, but time travel is an interesting concept in a role-playing game, isn't it? So, yeah. I was thinking more, not so much the player characters with a witch that comes from the past, but the player characters coming from the past. What if the player characters are, she casts a spell and the player characters are witch finders from the past looking for the witch in a modern setting? Because that's always fun, isn't it? It's always fun. It's like the first sort of 10 minutes, 15 minutes of this. There is a sort of fun about her not understanding the real world, you know, and not understanding the real world, but the modern world and the light is kind of always kind of fun in things, isn't it? Time travel. Either people going into the future, then the world's very, very different, or people from the past not understanding our world. I always think in role playing, it's always a bit underplayed, that, isn't it? You don't get many games about time travel.
Possible two-parter, isn't it? To have the pursuit of the witch, and then at the point where the pursuit of someone who has powers, and at the point where the final confrontation, they disappear, and they disappear through time, and you as player characters have to find where they've gone and try and find them in time.
Or the other way around, modern characters being sent back in time to the time of the witch trials. Those kind of ideas are, you know, as well as the horror aspect of it, time travel is just an interesting role playing opportunity, isn't it? Because you get sort of like, and we might talk about this in a minute, but you know, like post apocalyptic games where characters find things from the past that they're not supposed to understand. So you always get that role playing thing, don't you, in post apocalyptic games of, oh, you found a Walkman, you know, but you don't know what it is and you've got to work out what it is. But that's a kind of interesting thing with time travel, isn't it? That you can play around with the idea that you're from the past. So you have to role play the modern world, like you don't know what the modern world is.
Yeah.
You've got to react to it and pretend you don't know what a computer is, you don't know what a car is, you don't know what a plane is, don't know what a, you know, electric light is, and role play that is an interesting idea that you don't hear much of it, you know.
Yeah. They're definitely a rich source of material still, these Hammer House of Horrors. I'm going to watch some more. I recommend people do it. They're on ITVX, on streaming service. I think you can pick them up on DVD. I'd skip the third episode, Rude Awakening, the one with Denham Elliotin, because, I mean, there's titillation and there's a dramatisation of the Razzle's letters page.
I've not seen that one. I don't remember that.
Give it a skip.
Are you sure? In the interest of research.
Cheers, Blythe.
Goodbye.
I'll get me caught. We're heading towards the door. It's the time for closing time chatter. And I thought this time, Blythe, in the closing time chatter, it's just been a virtual grog meet. I've not caught up with you to see how yours went.
It went very well. Yeah. Oh, cool. I played some Liminal with Abs, set in Edinburgh, which was a lot of fun. With Liminal setting it in a city that Abs lives there and knows very well. He's very involved in the kind of cultural life there. I like that idea of, you know, you're in a real place. Again, back to what I was saying earlier, you're in a real place and you're going around real places. It was like a combination of a guided tour of some of those stranger locations in Edinburgh, which are real locations. So
you know. So you probably saved a fortune on going on one of those ghost walks.
Yeah, I'd have to go on that. I've seen all the pictures of all these places, yeah.
Abs, when he does those Liminal games, he takes some time, doesn't he, to embed you into the location. And uses the crew elements.
Yeah, I was a new member of the crew, so I had to kind of introduce myself and ingratiate myself to the crew before they kind of took me on.
Because those crew rules, when you've got a one-shot, there's a tendency to kind of overlook those, but they are a key element into how Liminal works, isn't it? That sense of why are you doing this?
Why are you doing it? Yeah, they are really. I know that is always the thing with one-shots, isn't it? About the idea that all the character creation element and all that is glossed over a little bit, you know. Oh, well, you're these characters, you've all got together to do this, blah, 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 let's get on with it. But sometimes that can be part of the fun, can't it? I think we always say, rolling characters is part of the game. You know, we were at Eddie's, weren't we, the other week, and we rolled characters for Open Quest. You know, we actually rolled the characters for it. It was just like a one-shot he'd done, but we rolled characters. And you forget. It's easy to forget that, isn't it? It's part of the game. Yeah, it's part of the game.
Yeah.
You tend to roll characters up. We certainly roll characters up when we're doing campaigns.
It begs the question whether rolling a full character for a convention game is fun and entertaining. But I do think that grounding the relationship and not having those pre-configured is a good idea. Roderick, at a recent game that we had, he had kind of a cool little technique where we had to go around the table and roll a D10. 1 to 2, we hated a particular character and had a grudge against them.
Yeah.
And if it was 9 to 10, then we loved a particular other player character and enjoyed being in their company and the reasons for that. Yeah. And if it was in between there, we were neutral about them. I thought that was a really quick way of going around the table and saying, this is what I think about you. That helped to play out and it breaks some of the ice sometimes, that kind of technique, doesn't it?
I am quite a fan of rolling characters up for convention game. I think it gives players a little bit more investment into the character. It's obviously tricky. There are some games where it's impossible.
Yeah.
It's impossible to do it. because it's too involved. But what you can do, I think, is like a hybrid way of doing it. So, for example, I ran Mutant Year Zero for Virtual Grogmeet, which I enjoyed running, and I'm going to run it again for MorpCon and possibly UK Games Expo. And what I'm doing with that is the characters are pre-gen, but the mutation will be randomly generated. So they won't know what the mutation is until they sit down and pick a character, and then they're going to get a random mutation. And that's kind of fun as well, because it just adds a little bit of character creation.
And also, if you have a character sheet, if you can do a pre-gen, that's a bit like a playbook where people can make some choices, choose three of these or whatever. People do have an investment. I did Wages of Fear, which is set in, which I've talked about extensively before, so I'm not going to go into too much here, but it's my scenario set in the Day After Ragnarok setting based around the Wages of Fear or Sorcerer, where player characters have to escort a highly explosive truck over terrain from one place to another. And your point about investment in characters actually came up, because towards the end, because you know this is when they explode, people were being quite cavalier about it, because there were that sense of playing a one-shot, like characters, like you stole them.
Part
of the joy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And one of the players said, remember, your characters don't know that they're in a one-shot.
Yes, that is true, yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit of an RPG flaw, isn't it? A little bit of a mistake, that, isn't it? If you think about good role-playing, surely the character you're playing doesn't care. It does care about dying. He doesn't want to die. So what would you be cavalier with them? Yeah.
It was good to get that run out again, but it did bring up the issue of Savage Worlds Online. Mm. Oh my goodness. I didn't allow enough time for me to get ready for it, because composing the character sheets, getting all the bits ready for the turn taking and all those elements, it's kind of investment, isn't it? And you do really need, you can play Theatre of the Mind, but you really do need the play mats, don't you, for Savage Worlds, because positions become into it and it can get quite complicated.
Yeah, that's its roots in a skirmish game, so yeah that kind of comes across. I think as well, it's a funny game, isn't it, because we've got a lot of time for Savage World. I really like it. But I must admit, I would like to run it more at conventions, but I do always hesitate slightly before I've lost count of the number of times where a convention's come up and people want games submitted, and I go, oh, I need to run some Savage Worlds, and then I hesitate, because I know that for people who've not played it, it somehow can be a bit bewildering. It's not a complicated, I don't think it's a complicated game, but then again, I don't know, it's like anything, isn't it? You say it's not complicated. Yeah, it's not complicated because you've played hours and hours and hours and hours of it. So what that's supposed to mean, you know.
Yeah.
But I do think it has a... I think what the good things about it, things I like about it, like the exploding dice, and the wounds, and the wear, the toughness rule, and all those bits, particularly the combat system, that are really good, are actually the things that sometimes people struggle to get their heads around. So it's got this kind of weird thing of all these things are really good, but they are the things that you will struggle with, because we struggled with them a little bit when we first started playing it, didn't we?
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem with it. You know, it's a great game, but it's
the I think as well, when you're playing it online as a convention game, it's not always visible what's going on, because some of the hard work's been done in the background.
Mm.
So for you to explain what's actually happening, to get the calculation, it's not as thrilling as rolling the physical dice and seeing them explode, for example, or having the cards in front of you turning over and you can see what turn it is. I've said this before about Savage, it's a physical game, isn't it? It's one that really benefits from the exchange and the movement of items around the table. I enjoyed it, don't get me wrong, but it just felt like effort to get it going?
I think it's, I don't think it's unique to Savage Worlds, though, is it? I mean, I ran Mutiny Zero, and that's not too complicated. And I ran Nave, stop laughing at the back, Nave. And I really enjoyed running Nave because it's quite straightforward. It allows for character creation at the beginning of the session. And also, I think it's a game where you need to do that because people need to make some tactical choices when they create the character that if you do it as a GM, might seem a bit unfair. It's one of those, isn't it, where it's a convention for one shot. And if people have not played the game before, you realize you're slipping into game demo territory rather than playing the game. So you've written a scenario that you want to run as a scenario and you're very excited about it, but you realize when you've got four players, you've never played the game before. If that game is complicated, you are essentially running, it feels like you're running a demo. Whereas something like Nave, for example, people haven't played it before. I think Neil had read the rules, but they haven't played it before. But it didn't take them long to get into the game because there's a few moving parts, but it's not too complicated.
Yes.
And as a one-shot, the more one-shots I do, the more convention games I do, the more I'm drawn to simpler games because I've found myself in that position where I've thought, blimey, this just feels like a demo game, this.
Yes.
I'm a bit bored because all I'm doing is really explaining loads of intricate rules to people. And that doesn't mean those complicated games are rubbish, because they sometimes complicated games can eventually bring a lot to it. Savage Worlds, over time, you can really benefit from playing a more complicated game. But when it comes to conventions, I think simple is better.
And I've certainly felt that about D-Sanction. So I ran the scenario again, by the pricking of the thumbs that I did for you guys as part of the One Shot Club. Mm. And that was really good because, the rules are dead simple and the setting and setup draws out people wanting to engage with the characters and engage with the world. So I really enjoyed running that.
Simplicity is best at convention.
I want to play more D-Sanction. I really enjoy it. I really enjoy the mood of that era and the whole concept of, magic being in the world. And
it's a good era in history, isn't it? Because it's an era where it's far enough in the past to feel like it's the past, but it's not so far in the past to make it feel like weird and alien, where you don't really know what people would have been like.
And going back to your earlier point about Abs and him inhabiting Edinburgh, and because he was familiar with it, being able to bring it to life. I did it in the county of Lancaster, and it's all places that I'm familiar with, and there's still artifacts and places that exist in our look, where I am in my neighborhood that survive from that period. Yeah. So you can draw upon that and bring that to life. And, the idea of Pendle Hill and Horse and Tower, which is very near to me, these places still exist and you can visit them and get a sense of what life was like. And it fuels the imagination.
That's kind of what I mean. It's in the past. It's a long way in the past, but you can still kind of almost reach out and touch it. Whereas if you go further back, it becomes a trickier proposition, doesn't it? The further you go back, if you set something in the Roman Empire, for example, it all becomes a bit, I suppose it becomes more like a movie, doesn't it? More like Gladiator rather than actual history. Whereas that Tudor period, you've still got a grip of what life was like. There's evidence around, and like you say, around here there's all sorts of buildings and things, stuff that from that era that still exists.
It was another good one. I need to thank Keith and Scott as well for running the quiz for us. It was a great presentation. It was high tech with animations and all sorts. Very impressive.
Whoever does it next time has to beat that. That's the trouble, isn't it? So or have they just got a job for life now?
Yeah. So thanks for the Titty Pigs podcast for hosting that for us this time. It was great fun and a great start to it. So that's it. Right, Blythe. I think in this episode, we'll have to put one of those explicit warnings on.
Do you think so? It talks about what Satanism. And
well, I think the fact that we've mentioned Razzle and Knave in the same episode.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's an RPG, though, not, you know.
If anybody's got any problem, just have a word with your grandma and she'll let them in, won't you?
Well, you need to have a seance now to do that, but, you know. But then again, you know, I don't know. It's another Harris of Horror story there, isn't it? You know, I contact my chain-smoking grandma and seek permission to watch inappropriate TV.
I saw with a pick and mix, love.
Can I watch Hammer House of Horror? What, tap once for yes, twice for no. Three times we don't care.
Cheers, buddy.
Goodbye.
I'm Steve, host of All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes, a podcast documenting my ongoing mission to run or at least play all of the RPGs that I seem to be incapable of stopping myself buying.
And you'll see me frequently fiddling with something in my hands.
Each episode, I get together with a group of fellow gamers that have either played a game I've run or who've GM'd a game for me. We chat through what we've enjoyed about the game and some ways we could have improved the experience whilst making a series of terrible jokes along the way.
Was it hot chat action?
Sometimes we con game designers who really should know better to come along and talk to us about their games and maybe run an actual play segment to give us an idea of their vision for their game.
I've told this story before, won't bore anyone.
Our topics range from old school favourites like RuneQuest through to some of those newfangled narrative games all the cool kids talk about. When you listen, I want you to feel as though you're sitting around our gaming table, taking part in our post-game chat and helping dispose of the last of the crisps and ale.
I'll just wax my bowstring and think about the death of the tainted.
Oh no, 898.
So, if you like listening to people droning on excitedly about games in a range of regional British accents, All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes is the pod for you, and you'll find it on your podcasting app of choice. On occasion, you may even hear something really insightful, but I'm making no promises. Over to you, Dave.
Point to Bonkses and make it a Titan.
Keep it high.
There isn't another bit. Blimey, Charlie. It was a long one, this one, wasn't it? Ah, well. I hope you took it at your own pace. Thanks to Steve for coming onto the show again, and I put a link in the show notes to the latest of his shows on the road and the details of how you get your own copies of the Scarred for Life books. Volume 3 is very much adjacent to the content in the podcast. You'll find loads of coverage of the games we discuss here and much, much more. I can't recommend it highly enough. As for Toni Arthur, the television presenter from Play Away and Play School, well, she was referenced in an earlier Grog Pod. Can you remember which one? There'll be another virtual online convention in 2025, the 7th to the 9th of November, and if you want to know more, follow the page at thegrognardfiles.com. Thanks for listening to us. I hope you enjoyed it. And special thanks to the patrons who support us financially with a tip in the beret every month over at Patreon. It's really appreciated, and a few big bills for the hosting, etc., come out at this point of the year, so thanks for keeping the show on the road. We've produced another Patreon-exclusive podcast, Dirk's Dossier. It's a bit more loose and informal than this, but it does recover some of the scenes that end up on the cutting room floor for one reason or another. It includes a discussion that me and Blythe had after the Rivers of London interview with Ben Aronovich, with me and Blythe talking, and we didn't really fit into the programme, so you can now listen to it if you sign up to be a member of Patreon. We've had some new patrons too, so I'll give them an individual shout-out at the end of the next episode and give them a virtual magical gift. Can you remember which episode Toni Arthur was last mentioned? It was episode 12. Tim Olson, who worked at Dalling Road Games Workshop, was interviewed by Toni Arthur for Good Morning Britain. I'll put a link to that in the show notes too.
Well, that's it for this episode. Please let us know about your experience of Hammer House of Horror and the other influences that you had on your games. Love to hear them. And we love to hear from anybody, just to know that there's somebody out there listening. Until next time, hearken. Hearken. What is that sound? Adios, amigos.
Oh, Alison Cross, the thing yon tower, as ugly as could be. She asked the young knight to her bower, and flattering words spoke she. Lines twine the willow day. She stroked his head and combed his hair and sat him by her knee. If you will be my lover true, five things I will give to thee. Lines twine the willow day. She showed him a cloak of scarlet red with flowers and fringing fine. If you will be my lover true, this gift it shall be thine. Lines twine the willow day. Away, away, you ugly witch, away and let me be. I never will be your lover true, nor keep your company. Lines twine the willow day. Line twine the willow day. Away, away, you ugly witch, away and let me go. I never once kissed your ugly lips for all that you could show. Line twine the willow day. Three times she's